Chapter 3. Some 24 hours after Monty Bodkin had put in his long-distance call to Matchingham 8-3, an observant bird, winging its way over Blandings Castle and taking a bird's-eye view of its parks, gardens and messages, would have noticed a couple walking up and down the terrace which fronts the main entrance of that stately home of England. And narrowing its gaze and shading its eyes with a claw, for the morning sun was strong, it would have seen that one of the pair was a small, sturdy young man of pink complexion, the other an extremely pretty girl in a green linen dress with a Quaker collar. Ronald Overbury Fish was saying goodbye to his Sue, preparatory to driving into Market Blandings and taking the 12:40 train east. He was going to Norfolk to be the best man at the wedding of his cousin George. He did not anticipate that the parting would be a long one, for he expected to return on the morrow. Nevertheless, he felt constrained to give Sue a few words of advice as to her deportment during his absence. First and foremost, he urged, she must use every feminine wile to fascinate his Uncle Clarence. "Right," said Sue. She was a tiny girl with an enchanting smile and big blue eyes. These last were now sparkling with ready intelligence. She followed his reasoning perfectly. Lord Emsworth, though he had promised Ronnie his money, had not yet given it to him, and might conceivably change his mind. Obviously, therefore, he must be fascinated. The task, moreover, would not be a distasteful one. In the brief time during which she had had the pleasure of his acquaintance, she had grown very fond of that mild and dreamy peer. "Right," she said. "Keep surging him round like glue." "Right," said Sue. "In fact, I think you'd better go and talk pig to him the moment I've left." "Right," said Sue. "And about Aunt Constance," said Ronnie. He paused, frowning. He always frowned when he thought of his aunt, Lady Constance Keeble. When Ronald Fish, the last of the Fishes, only son of Lady Julia Fish and nephew to Clarence, 9th Earl of Emsworth, had announced that a marriage had been arranged and would shortly take place between himself and a unit of the Regal Theatre Chorus, he had had what might be called a mixed press. Some of the notices were good, others not. Beach, the castle butler, who'd fostered for 18 years a semi-paternal attitude towards Ronnie and had fallen in love with Sue at first sight, liked the idea. So did the Honourable Galahad Threepwood, who, when a dashing young man about town in the 90s, had wanted to marry Sue's mother. As for Lord Emsworth himself, he had said, "Oh? Ah!" in an absent voice on hearing the news and had gone on thinking about pigs. It was, as so often happens on these occasions, from the female side of the family that the jarring note had proceeded. Women are seldom without their class prejudices. Their views on the importance of rank diverge from those of the poet Burns. We have seen how Lady Julia felt about the match. The disapproval of her sister Constance was equally pronounced. She grieved over this blot which was about to be splashed upon the escutcheon of a proud family and let the world see that she was grieved. She sighed a good deal, and when she was not sighing, kept her lips tightly pressed together. So now, when Ronnie mentioned her name, he frowned. "About Aunt Constance!" He was going on to add that should his Aunt Constance have the nerve during his absence to put on dog and do an air of that haughty county stuff to his betrothed, the latter should be well advised to kick her in the face. When there emerged from the house a young man with marcelled hair, a shifty expression, and a small and repellent moustache. He stood for an instant on the threshold, hesitated, caught Ronnie's eye, smiled weakly, and disappeared again. Ronnie stood gazing tensely at the spot where he had been. "Little blighter," he growled, grinding his teeth gently. The sight of P. Frobisher Pilbeam always tended to wake the fiend that slept in Ronald Fish. "Looking for you, I suppose?" Sue started nervously. "Oh, I shouldn't think so. We've hardly spoken for days." "He doesn't ever bother you now?"
"Oh, no."
"What's he doing here, anyway? I thought he'd left."
"I suppose Lord Emsworth asked him to stay on."
"What does he matter?" "He used to send you flowers."
"I know, but
he trailed you to that restaurant that night."
"I know, but surely you aren't worried about him any longer."
"Me?" said Ronnie. "No, of course not."
He spoke a little gruffly, for he was embarrassed. It is always embarrassing for a young man of sensibility to realize that he is making a priceless ass of himself. He knew perfectly well that there was nothing between Sue and this pill-beam perisher, and never had been anything, and yet the sight of him about the place could make him flush and scowl and get all throaty. Of course, the whole trouble with him was that where Sue was concerned, he suffered from an inferiority complex. He found it so difficult to believe that a girl like her could really care for a bird so short and pink as himself. He was always afraid that one of these days it would suddenly dawn upon her what a mistake she'd made in supposing herself to be in love with him, and would race off and fall in love with somebody else. Not Pillbeam, of course, but suppose somebody tall and lissome came along. Sue was pressing her point. She wanted this thing settled and out of the way. The only cloud on her happiness was that tendency of her Ronald's towards jealousy, to which Hugo Carmody had alluded so feelingly in his conversation with Monty Bodkin. Jealousy, when two people had come together and knew that they loved one another, always seemed to her silly and incomprehensible. She had the frank, uncomplicated mind of a child. "You promise you won't worry about him again?"
"Absolutely not."
"Nor about anybody else?"
"Positively not. Couldn't possibly happen again."
He paused.
"The only thing is," he said broodingly, "I am so dashed short."
"You're just the right height."
"And pink."
"My favourite colour. You're a precious little pink cherub, and I love you."
"You really do?"
"Of course I do."
"But suppose you change your mind?"
"You're a chump, Ronnie."
"I know I'm a chump, but I still say, suppose you change your mind."
"It's much more likely that you'll change yours."
"What?"
"Suppose when your mother arrives, she talks you over."
"What absolute rot!
I don't imagine she will approve of me."
"Of course she'll approve of you."
"Lady Constance doesn't." Ronnie uttered a spirited cry.
"Aunt Constance! I was trying to think who it was we were talking about when that pill-beam blister came to a head. Listen, if Aunt Constance tries to come the old aristocrat over you while I'm away, punch her in the eye. Don't put up for a moment with any pursed lip and lorgnette stuff."
"And what do I do when your mother reaches for her lorgnette?"
"Oh, you won't have anything of that sort from Mother."
"Hasn't she got a lorgnette?"
"Mother's all right."
"Not like Lady Constance?"
"A bit. To look at, but quite different, really. Aunt Constance is straight Queen Elizabeth. Mother's a cheery soul."
"She'll try to talk you over all the same."
"She won't."
"She will. Ronald, my dear boy, really, this absurd infatuation, most extraordinary. I can feel it in my bones."
"Mother couldn't talk like that if you paid her. I keep telling you, she's a genial egg."
"She won't like me."
"Of course she'll like you. Don't be..."
"What the dickens is that word?" Sue was biting her lip with her small, very white tooth. Her blue eyes had clouded. "I wish you weren't going away, Ronnie."
"It's only for tonight."
"Have you really got to go?"
"Afraid so. Can't very well let poor old George down. He's relying on me. Besides, I want to watch his work at the altar rails, pick up some hints on technique which will come in useful when you and I..."
"If ever we do..."
"Do stop talking like that,"
begged Ronnie. "I'm sorry, but I do wish you hadn't got to go away. I'm scared. It's this place. It's so big and old. Makes me feel like a puppy that's got into a cathedral."
Ronnie turned and gave his boyhood home an appraising glance.
"I suppose it's a fairly decent-sized old shack," he admitted, having run his eye up to the battlements and back again. "I never really gave the thing much thought before, but now you mention it, I have seen smaller places, but there's nothing about it to scare anybody."
"There is. If you were born and brought up in a villa in the suburbs, I feel that at any moment all the ghosts of your ancestors will come popping out, pointing at me and shouting, 'What business have you here, you little rat?'"
"They'd better not let me catch them at it," said Ronnie warmly. "Don't be so... what on earth is that word? I know it begins with an M. You mustn't feel like that. You've gone like a breeze here. Uncle Clarence likes you. Uncle Galley likes you. Everybody likes you. Except Aunt Constance. And a fat lot we care about what Aunt Constance thinks, what?"
"I keep worrying about your mother."
"And I keep telling you..."
"I know. But I've got that funny feeling you get sometimes when things are going to happen. Trouble. Trouble. A dark lady coming over the water."
"Mother's fair.
It doesn't make it any better. I've got that presentiment."
"Well, I don't see why you should. Everything's gone without a hitch so far."
"That's just what I mean. I've been so frightfully happy, and I feel that all the beastly things that spoil happiness are just biding their time, waiting. They can't do nothing till Martin gets here.
Eh?
I was thinking of a thing one of the girls used to play on her gramophone in the dressing room the last show I was in. It was about a Negro who goes to a haunted house, and demon cats keep coming in, each bigger and more horrible than the last. And as each one comes in, it says to the others, "Shall we start in on him now?" And they shake their heads and say, "Not yet. We can't do nothing till Martin gets here." Well, I can't help feeling that Martin soon will be here. Ronnie had found the word for which he had been searching.
Morbid. I knew it began with an M. Don't be so dashed morbid.
Sue gave herself a little shake, like a dog coming out of a pond. She put her arm in Ronnie's and gave it a squeeze. I suppose it is morbid.
Of course it is.
Everything may be all right.
Everything's going to be fine. Mother will be crazy about you. She won't be able to help herself because of all the...
On the verge of becoming lyrical, Ronnie broke off abruptly. The castle car had just come round the corner from the stables with Vools, the chauffeur, at the helm.
"I didn't know it was as late as that," said Ronnie discontentedly.
The car drew up beside them, and he eyed Vools with a touch of austerity. It was not that he disliked the chauffeur, a man whom he had known since his boyhood, and one with whom he had many a time played village cricket. It was simply that there are moments when a fellow wishes to be free from observation, and one of these is when he is about to bid farewell to his affianced. However, there was good stuff in Ronald Fish. Ignoring the chauffeur's eye, which betrayed a disposition to be roguish, he gathered his loved one to him and, his face now a pretty cerise, kissed her with all a fish's passion. This done, he entered the car, leant out of the window, waved, went on waving, and continued to wave till Sue was out of sight. Then, sitting down, he gazed straight before him, breathing a little heavily through the nostrils. Sue, having lingered until the car had turned the corner of the drive and was hidden by a clump of rhododendrons, walked pensively back to the terrace. The August sun was now blazing down in all its imperious majesty. Insects were chirping sleepily in the grass, and the hum of bees in the lavender borders united with the sun and the chirping to engender sloth. A little wistfully, Sue looked past the shrubbery at the cedar-shaded lawn where the Honourable Galahad Threepwood, thoughtfully sipping a whisky and soda, lay back in a deep chair, cool and at his ease. There was another chair beside him, and she knew that he had placed it there for her. But duty is duty, no matter how warm the sun and drowsy the drone of insects. Ronnie had asked her to go and talk pig to Lord Emsworth, and the task must be performed. She descended the broad stone steps and, turning westward, made for the corner of the estate sacred to that noble Berkshire sow, Empress of Blandings. The boudoir of the Empress was situated in a little meadow, dappled with buttercups and daisies, round two sides of which there flowed in a silver semicircle the stream which fed the lake. Lord Emsworth, as his custom was, had pottered off there directly after breakfast, and now, at 12:30, he was still standing, in company with his pigman Purbright, draped bonelessly over the rail of the sty, his mild eyes beaming with the light of a holy devotion. From time to time he sniffed sensuously. Elsewhere, throughout this fair domain, the air was fragrant with the myriad scents of high summer, but not where Lord Emsworth was doing his sniffing. Within a liberal radius of the Empress's headquarters, other scents could not compete. This splendid animal diffused an aroma which was both distinctive and arresting. Attractive, too, if you like that sort of thing, as Lord Emsworth did. Between Empress of Blandings and these two human beings who ministered to her comfort, there was a sharp contrast in physique. Lord Emsworth was tall and thin and scraggy, Purbright, tall and thin and scraggier. The Empress, on the other hand, could have passed in a dim light for a captive balloon, fully inflated and about to make its trial trip. The modern craze for slimming had found no votary in her. She liked her meals large and regular and had never done a reducing exercise in her life. watching her now as she tucked into a sort of hash of bran, acorns, potatoes, linseed and swill, the 9th Earl of Emsworth felt his heart leap up in much the same way as that of the poet Wordsworth used to do when he beheld a rainbow in the sky.
"What a picture, Pirbright," he said reverently.
"Her, m'lord."
"She's bound to win. Can't help herself."
"Her, m'lord."
"Unless... we mustn't let her get stolen again, Pirbright."
"Her, m'lord."
Lord Emsworth adjusted his pince-nez thoughtfully. The ecstatic pig gleam had faded from his eyes. His face was darkened by a cloud of concern. He was thinking of that bad baronet, Sir Gregory Parslow. The theft of the Empress and the subsequent discovery of her in his ex-secretary Baxter's caravan had at first mystified Lord Emsworth completely. Why Baxter, though a recognized eccentric, should have been going about Shropshire stealing pigs seemed to him a problem incapable of solution. But calm reflection had brought the answer to the riddle. Obviously, the fellow had been a minion in the pay of Sir Gregory, operating throughout under orders from the big shot. And what was disquieting him now was the conviction that the danger was not yet past. Baffled once, the baronet, he felt, was crouching for another spring. With 2 weeks still to pass before the agricultural show, there was ample time for his subtle brain to conceive another hideous plot. At any moment, in short, the bounder was liable to come sneaking in, mask on face and poison needle in hand, intent on nobbling the favourite. His eyes roamed the paddock. It was a lonely spot, far from human habitation. A pig, assaulted here by baronets, might well cry for help unheard.
"Do you think she's safe in this sty, Pirbright?" he asked anxiously. "I feel we ought to move her to that new one by the kitchen garden. It's near your cottage."
What reply the vice-president in charge of pigs would have made to this suggestion, whether it would have been or yer or ner, will never be known. For at this moment there appeared a figure at the sight of whom he touched his forelock and receded respectfully into the background. Lord Emsworth, whose pince-nez had fallen off, put them on again and peered mildly, like a sheep looking over a fence.
"Ah! Connie, my dear."
There had been times when the sudden advent of his sister, Lady Constance Keeble, at a moment when he was drooping his long body over the rail of the Empress's sanctum, would have caused him agitation and discomfort. She had a way of appearing from nowhere and upbraiding him for expending on pigs time which had better have been devoted to correspondence connected with the business of the estate. But for the last 2 days, since the departure of that young fellow Carmody, he had had no secretary, and a man can't be expected to attend to his correspondence without a secretary. His conscience, accordingly, was clear, and he spoke with none of that irritable defensiveness, as of some wild creature at bay, which he sometimes displayed on these occasions.
"Ah, Connie, my dear, you are just in time to give me your advice. I was saying to Pirbright..."
Lady Constance did not wait for the sentence to be completed. In her dealings with the head of the family, she was always inclined to infuse into her manner a suggestion of a rather short-tempered nurse with a rather fat-headed child.
"Never mind what you were saying to Pirbright. Do you know what time it is?"
Lord Emsworth did not. He never did. Beyond a vague idea that when it got too dark for him to see the Empress at a range of 4 feet it was getting on for dinner time, he took little account of the hours.
"It's nearly one. We have people coming to lunch at 1:30.
Lord Emsworth assimilated this.
"Lunch? Oh, ah, yes. Yes, of course, lunch, to be sure. Yes, lunch. You think I ought to come in and wash my hands?"
"And your face. It's covered with mud. And change those clothes and those shoes and put on a clean collar. Really, Clarence, you're as much trouble as a baby. Why you want to waste your time staring at beastly pigs, I can't imagine."
Lord Emsworth accompanied her across the paddock, but his face, there was hardly any mud on it at all, really, just a couple of splashes or so, was sullen and mutinous. This was not the first time his sister had alluded in this offensive manner to one whom he regarded as the supreme ornament of her sex and species. Beastly pigs, indeed. He pondered moodily on the curious inability of his immediate circle to appreciate the importance of the Empress in the scheme of things. Not one of them seemed to have the sagacity to realize her true worth. Well, yes, one, perhaps. That little girl, what's her name, who was going to marry his nephew Ronald, had always displayed a pleasing interest in the silver medalist. "Nice girl," he said, following this train of thought to its conclusion.
"What are you talking about, Clarence?" asked Lady Constance wearily. "Who is a nice girl?"
"That little girl of Ronald's. I've forgotten her name. Smith, is it?"
"Brown," said Lady Constance shortly.
"That's right. Brown. Nice girl."
"You are entitled to your opinion, I suppose," said Lady Constance.
They walked on in silence for some moments.
"While we are on the subject of Miss Brown," said Lady Constance, speaking the name as she always did, with her teeth rather tightly clenched and a stony look in her eyes, "I forgot to tell you that I had a letter from Julia this morning."
"Did you?"
said Lord Emsworth, giving the matter some 2/57 of his attention.
"Capital, capital."
"Who,"
he asked politely,
"is Julia?"
Lady Constance was within easy reach of his head, and could quite comfortably have hit it, but she refrained. Noblesse oblige.
"Julia?"
she said, with a rising inflection.
"There's only one Julia in our family."
"Oh, you mean Julia,"
said Lord Emsworth, enlightened.
"And what had Julia got to say for herself? She's at Biarritz, isn't she?"
he said, making a great mental effort.
"Having a good time, I hope."
"She's in London."
"Oh, yes."
"And she's coming here tomorrow by the 2:45.
Lord Emsworth's vague detachment vanished. His sister Julia was not a woman to whose visits he looked forward with joyous enthusiasm.
"Why?"
he asked, with a strong note of complaint in his voice.
"It is the only good train in the afternoon and gets here in plenty of time for dinner. I mean, why is she coming?"
It would be too much to say that Lady Constance snorted. Women of her upbringing do not snort, but she certainly sniffed.
"Well, really," she said, "does it strike you as so odd that a mother whose only son has announced his intention of marrying a ballet girl should wish to see her?"
Lord Emsworth considered this.
"Not ballet girl. Chorus girl, I understood."
"It's the same thing."
"I don't think so," said Lord Emsworth doubtfully. "I must ask Galahad." A sudden idea struck him.
"Don't you like this Smith girl?"
"Brown."
"Don't you like this Brown girl?"
"I do not."
"Don't you want her to marry Ronald?"
"I should have thought I'd made my views on that matter sufficiently clear. I think the whole thing deplorable. I'm not a snob."
"But you are,"
said Lord Emsworth, cleverly putting his finger on a flaw in her reasoning. Lady Constance bridled.
"Well, if it is snobbish to prefer your nephew to marry in his own class,
Galahad would have married her mother 30 years ago if he hadn't been shipped off to South Africa."
"Galahad was and is capable of anything."
"I can remember her mother,"
said Lord Emsworth meditatively.
"Galahad took me to the Tivoli once when she was singing there. Dolly Henderson. Little bit of a thing in pink tights with the jolliest smile you ever saw. Made you think of spring mornings. The gallery joined in the chorus, I recollect. Bless my soul, how did it go now? Tum-tum-tum-ti-tum. Or was it hum-ti-tiddly-tiddly-pum?"
"Never mind how it went," said Lady Constance.
One reminiscence in the family, she considered, was quite enough.
"And we are not talking of the girl's mother. The only thing I have to say about Miss Brown's mother is that I wish she had never had a daughter."
"Well, I like her," said Lord Emsworth stoutly. "A very sweet, pretty, nice-mannered little thing and extremely sound on pigs. I was saying so to young Pilbeam only yesterday."
"Pilbeam?" cried Lady Constance.
She spoke with feeling, for the name had reminded her of another grievance. She had been wanting to get to the bottom of this Pilbeam mystery for days. About that young man's presence at the castle, there seemed to her something almost uncanny. She had no recollection of his arrival. It was as if he had materialized out of thin air. And being a conventional hostess, with a conventional hostess's dislike of the irregular, she objected to finding that visitors with horrible moustaches, certainly not invited by herself, had suddenly begun to pervade the home like an escape of gas.
"Who is that nasty little man?"
she demanded.
"He's an investigator."
"A what?"
"A private investigator. He investigates. Privately."
There was a touch of quiet pride in Lord Emsworth's voice. He was 60 years old, and this was the first time he'd ever found himself in the romantic role of an employer of private investigators.
"He runs the something detective agency, the Argus, that's it, the Argus Private Inquiry Agency."
Lady Constance breathed emotionally.
"Ballet girls? Detectives? I wonder you don't invite a few skittlesharps here."
Lord Emsworth said he did not know any skittlesharps.
"And is one permitted to ask what a private detective is doing as a guest at Blandling's Castle?"
"I got him down to investigate that mystery of the Empress's disappearance."
"Well, that idiotic pig of yours has been back in her sty for days. What possible reason can there be for this man staying on?"
"Ah, that was Galahad's idea. It was Galahad's suggestion that he should stay on till after the agricultural show. He thought it would be a good thing to have somebody like that handy in case Parslow tried any more of his tricks.
Clarence?"
"And I consider," went on Lord Emsworth firmly, "that he was quite right. I know it was Baxter who actually stole me, Peg, and you will no doubt say that Baxter is notoriously potty, but Galahad feels, and I feel, that it was not primarily his pottiness that led him to steal the Empress. We both think that Parslow was behind the whole thing. And Galahad maintains, and I agree with him, that it is only a question of time before he makes another attempt. So, the more watchers we have on the place, the better, especially if they have trained minds and are used in mixing with criminals like Pilbeam."
"Clarence, you're insane."
"No, I'm not insane," retorted Lord Emsworth warmly. "I know Parslow. And Galahad knows Parslow. You should read some of the stories about him in Galahad's book. Thoroughly well-documented stories, he assures me, showing the sort of man he was when Galahad used to go about London with him in their young days. Are you aware that in the year 1894, Parslow filled Galahad's dog Towser up with steak and onions just before the big rat contest, so that his own terrier Banjo should win? A fellow who stuck at nothing to attain his ends. And he's just the same today. Hasn't changed a bit. Look at the way he stole that man well-beloved away from me. The chap who used to be my pigman before Pirbright. Fellow capable of that is capable of anything."
Lady Constance spurned the grass with a frenzied foot. She would have preferred to kick her brother with it, but one has one's breeding.
"You are a perfect imbecile about Sir Gregory," she cried. "You ought to be ashamed of yourself. So ought Galahad, if it were possible for him to be ashamed of anything. You're behaving like a couple of half-witted children. I hate this idiotic quarrel. If there's one thing that's detestable in the country, it's being on bad terms with one's neighbours."
"I don't care how bad terms I'm on with Parslow."
"Well, I do, and that is why I was so glad to oblige him when he rang up about his nephew."
"Eh?"
"I was delighted to have the chance of proving to him that there was at least one sane person in Blandings Castle."
"Nephew? What nephew?"
"Young Montague Bodkin. You ought to remember him. He was here often enough when he was a boy."
"Bodkin? Bodkin? Bodkin?"
"Oh, for pity's sake, Clarence, don't keep saying Bodkin as if you were a parrot. If you have forgotten him, as you forget everything that happened more than 10 minutes ago, it does not matter in the least. The point is that Sir Gregory asked me as a personal favour to engage him as your secretary."
Lord Emsworth was a mild man, but he could be stirred.
"Well, I'm dashed! Well, I'm hanged!
The man steals my pig, man, and engineers the theft of my pig, and he has the nerve, and I said I should be delighted. What? I said I should be delighted. You don't mean you've done it? Certainly, it's all arranged. You mean you're letting a nephew of Parslow's loose in Blandings Castle with 2 weeks to go before the agricultural show?
He arrives tomorrow by the 2:45, said Lady Constance. And as she had thrown her bomb and seen it explode and had now reached the front door and had no wish to waste her time listening to futile protests, she swept into the house and left Lord Emsworth standing. He remained standing for perhaps a minute. Then the imperative necessity of sharing this awful news with a cooler, wiser mind than his own stirred him into life and activity. His face drawn, his long legs trembling beneath him, he hurried toward the lawn where his brother Galahad, whiskey and soda in hand, reclined in his deck chair.